Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Nall, and this is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Today, peak oil and the socio-economic impact of depleting fossil fuel resources. My guest, from Oregon, Kirk Cobb. He is an author, columnist who speaks and writes frequently on peak oil, energy, and the environment. He's a regular contributor to the Christian Science Monitor, and he's written many columns for the Paris-based science news site Citizen. His writings have been featured in Resilience, The Oil Drum, OilPrice.com, Investing.com, Peak Oil Review, Common Dreams, La Mode, and other publications. He is a graduate from Stanford University. He is also a novelist, Prelude, and his website is resourceinsights.blogspot.com. He is joined from Wisconsin by Dr. Nate Higgins. Dr. Higgins is a well-known authority on fossil fuel, peak oil, and resource depletion. He's the former lead editor of The Oil Drum, one of the most popular and highly respected websites for analysis and commentary on global energy supplies and the socioeconomic impact of declining oil resources. He's a board member of the Post Carbon Institute and works closely with the Institute for the Study of Energy and Our Future. He's also on the board. Prior to his journalistic research and reporting, he was the president of Sanctuary Asset Management and a vice president with Solomon Brothers and Lehman Brothers investment firms. He holds advanced degrees from the University of Chicago and a doctorate in natural resources from the University of Vermont. He appears on PBS, NPR, and the BBC. And his website and writings can be found at themonkeytrap.us. Nice to have you with us today.
Thanks for having me.
Let's begin with you, Kurt. Before we get into certain specifics regarding the nation's energy policies and the myths it is telling to the American public, and then sort through the long and short-term socioeconomic impacts of a collapse of fossil fuel resources, I want to also look at what it's going to be doing not just to our country but globally. I'd like you to first summarize what is meant by peak oil, because this is not a simple linear measurement, as I understand it. For example, a downward trend immediately after half an oil reserve is depleted, which is the way most people think about it. So first explain briefly what peak oil means, and then give us an overview of where the world now stands with respect to peak oil, with its existing well reserves in the leading oil-producing nations like Russia, Saudi Arabia, Iran, China, Canada, Iraq, United Arab Emirates, and Venezuela.
Well, first of all, Gary, thanks for having me on. I'm looking forward to talking to you and to Nate about the world energy situation. Let me try to give people a clear idea of what peak oil means. First of all, peak oil does not mean running out. Frequently, people who are critics of the peak oil idea say, well, it's not running out. Well, that's right. That's not what peak oil means. What it means is that the rate of production has reached its all-time high, and this is for any resource, any finite resource, not just oil, and is beginning, will shortly begin a decline. And that decline can be bumpy, it can be, it can have some upslopes to it, but the idea is that once the peak is reached, we'll never go back to that level. Sometimes you mentioned it, that it happens when half the resource has been used. Sometimes it happens when 60-65% of a resource is used in a field, sometimes less. So the amount that's remaining in the field differs. The main, the most important thing for people to remember is that peak oil or peak water or peak, you know, any other resource is about the rate of production, not about what's in the ground, because we really don't know exactly what's in the ground. It's important to make the distinction between resources and reserves. The oil industry and other industries will try to confuse the public by saying we have enormous resources, which is true, but only a small fraction of those resources are ever going to be recovered and made available to society. And what we know about resources is based on very sketchy geological evidence. The only way you can figure out what you have in the way of reserve in an oil field, for example, is to actually drill it and see what's there. And those reserves are actually much, much smaller than what we call resources. So don't be fooled by that. Now, what's the world situation? Well, right now, what we've seen in the last 7 years, and I've got complete data up through 2012, the 2013 data isn't all quite in. We've seen a significant slowdown in the rate of increase of oil production. Now, prior to 2005, the 7 years prior to 2005, oil production increased 9.9% total. From 2005 to 2012, it increased 2.7%. So that's about one quarter of the rate that we've been used to prior to 2005. And that's having a significant impact on everything we do because oil is so central to the world economy. It's central to transportation, where it provides something like 95% of all transportation fuels. It's central to agriculture. And it's central to so many of the other things that we do in society. So that slowdown has had a huge impact, and one of the impacts that we see is in the form of price. Now, a lot of people will remember, Gary, back in 2008 when we had this huge price spike way up to $147 a barrel, and they'll think of that as the peak. Well, if you look at the average daily price of oil, worldwide price, this is based on the Brent crude benchmark, what that tells us is that oil has been pricier in 2011, 2012, and 2013 than it was in 2008 on an average daily price. So in 2011, for example, it was $111.26 on average every day. 2012, $111.63. And last year it came down just a bit, $108.56. So this is the highest average daily price ever. We are living in an era of very expensive energy. And like I said, I think you're going to have Nate Higgins on later, and Nate is going to, I think, give you a good explanation of how these high prices are impacting the rest of society. Now, I don't know if you want me to go on and talk about natural gas and coal, but I'd be happy to do that.
Yes, that would be a follow-up.
Okay. In terms of coal, we don't really know how much coal we have left because we don't have any comprehensive surveys of world coal supplies. And this is one thing that was noted by the National Academy of Sciences in 2007. They actually looked at this issue and they said, this claim that the United States has 250 years of coal at current rates of consumption, there's no basis for it. So people are just making it up. And they said, well, maybe we have 100 years of coal at current rates of consumption. Now, note that I'm saying at current rates of consumption. That's another thing that the industry does. They pretend as if we aren't ever going to increase the rate of consumption, which would bring down the number of years that we'd have in terms of supply. But the truth is nobody knows. We haven't done a comprehensive survey. The last time, for example, the Chinese updated their coal reserves, and remember, China's they're the largest coal producer in the world. They haven't updated their reserves since 1992, and so far they produced maybe 20 to 30% of them. So we just don't know where things are. I've seen the Energy Watch Group out of Germany look at this incomplete data and say, based on what we know, global coal supplies could peak in the year as early as 2025. So that would be a shock because we're expecting coal to provide energy to us far in the future. Now, I'm not even trying to address climate change here. I'm just talking about fossil fuel supplies. In terms of natural gas, we do have an awful lot of natural gas. Most of it is found in the Middle East. I know you're hearing a lot about the energy renaissance in America, which we can talk about a little later. But actually, most of the natural gas in the world is still in the Middle East. Iran is has one of the largest reserves outside of the Middle East. Russia has one of the largest reserves. So I think that the idea that we're going to get away from imported natural gas for places like Europe and for places like China and Japan is not going to happen. We may get away from so many imports here in the United States because of the shale gas phenomenon for a while, but I think that's going to be short-lived. So that's a fair summary of the three major fossil fuels worldwide.
Back in November, President Obama tried to associate the increased production of U.S. oil and gas, are producing more oil now than we import, and declaring fossil fuel energy independence to a bright future of economic growth. We heard echoes of this again during his State of the Union speech. And then there is also the hydrofracking boom that you just alluded to, and we're being told we have a lot of natural gas, and that we're also abundant in both the hydrofracking and the natural gas. So we've got plenty of natural energy for America's future, and they're deeming this gas green, and they deem nuclear green. Now, overall, the government and our complacent mainstream media are telling us that we have a copious wealth of fossil fuel, and America has entered a new energy renaissance that will reduce energy costs, provide jobs, generate revenues, with the indication the country will be an exporter of fossil fuels rather than an importer. So I'd like you to begin with first deconstructing the rhetoric we are hearing about the new oil and natural gas renaissance. And what are the most telltale indications that what we are being told by the administration in the oil and gas industry is really more public relations than truth?
Well, Gary, I think you hit it on the head. I think it's a lot of public relations. It doesn't mean that fossil fuel supplies in the United States haven't risen in the last few years. They have. But we can expect that this is going to be a short-lived phenomenon. I think the reason that the industry is focusing so much on talking to people about rising fossil fuel production in the United States is because they want to change the conversation. This is what it's really about. They don't want to talk about climate change. They want to talk about energy renaissance, because that allows them to get more of their fossil fuels out of the ground and sell them to us and put more climate-changing gases into the air without discussing any kind of regulation there. So I think that's part of what their game is. But let's look at what people mean when they say American energy independence. We have long been self-sufficient in coal. That's not an issue. And when it comes to natural gas, in the last 20, 25 years, we've been importing around 15 or 16% of our natural gas from Canada, a stable, friendly country to the north of us. It's not as if we're getting our natural gas from the Middle East. So that hasn't really been an issue either. When people talk about American energy independence, what they're really talking about is all the imported oil that we bring into this country. And the chances that we're going to be free of that imported oil are almost zero. And here's why. Because even though today we're producing about 7.7 million barrels per day, we consume about 15. Now, of that, what's mixed in there is about a million barrels of gasoline and diesel and other products, refined products, that we export to other nations because we have so much refining capacity. So the difference between those two numbers, actually, when you get down into the numbers that the U.S. Energy Information Administration provides, and you do all the necessary calculations, what you realize is that we need we're importing about 6.4 million barrels per day of crude oil and refined products on a net basis. Now, the fracking boom that we've been hearing about that involves oil production is expected, the U.S. Energy Information Administration projects, that will peak out on total oil production again, just below the previous peak in 1970, at about 9.5 million barrels per day. Well, that's about 1.8 million barrels higher than what we are today, and that's going to happen in maybe 2 or 3 years. So that's far short of the 6.4 million that we need to be energy independent, and I just don't see how it's going to happen. The industry may talk about it happening, but that's part of their PR campaign to get you to stop thinking about climate change and stop thinking about moving from finite fossil fuels to renewable resources. Now, on the gas side, we've been told about this huge gas boom, and there indeed has been a boom in gas production. But curiously, since the beginning of 2012, that boom has flattened out and is almost imperceptible. We've had, from the beginning of 2012 to the end of 2013, less than a 1% rise in the amount of natural gas that we've been able to get out of American soil. And part of that is that the prices dropped so much. We overproduced in this big boom. The price went all the way down to about $1.82 per 1,000 cubic feet in April 2012. And now it's bounced back today to about $4.60. But there's a telltale sign that the companies can't even make money at that price, and that is the rig count, the number of rigs that they've put out into the field to drill gas. In September of 2008, which is really at the peak of the natural gas boom, there were 1,606 gas rigs out in the United States drilling for gas, natural gas. Today, we have the lowest number since that time, 351. That tells you that the companies have no confidence that there are many wells out there that could be profitable at this price. And if you look at the numbers that the companies, the actual drillers put out, what that tells you is that we're going to have natural gas between $6 and $8 a 1,000 cubic feet, maybe higher, in order to sustain getting this difficult-to-reach gas. Remember, this is thousands of feet down. This isn't conventional gas. And you have to break up the shale in order to get it to flow, and then it runs down very quickly. So this is we're moving from easy-to-get resources to hard-to-get resources. Those hard-to-get resources are more expensive. How much more expensive? If we're paying $6 to $8 a 1,000 cubic feet when this is all said and done. Keep in mind that in the 1990s in the United States, we were paying on average $1.92 per 1,000 cubic feet. So energy prices on natural gas, I think, will ultimately land 200 to 300% higher than what we've paid in the recent past. So again, we're in a high-cost environment, and that has implications for all of American society and actually all the world. Keep in mind that we're paying fairly low prices for natural gas compared to the world. In Japan, they have to bring it in as liquefied natural gas, which is expensive to bring on these tankers, and they're paying $17 a 1,000 cubic feet. In Europe, they're paying $12 a 1,000 cubic feet. So I know that there's been some discussion about us exporting natural gas, and if you'd like to talk about that at some point, I'd be happy to go into that.
Thank you. I appreciate those insights. There's also the gas hydrofracking, which is causing environmental destruction, is causing the increase in earthquakes. And there they've driven thousands of these wells into the ground. They're extrapolating their profit margins in these syndicates. And I'm told from people who are very familiar with the syndicates that they don't care about the gas as much as they care about getting in on the ground floor and being the first ones in and selling their shares in it, and that most of the people getting in now are going to lose their shirts. And also, some of these wells that they have drilled, and it's cost them over $1 million per well, they within 12 to 14 months, 90% of the gas is gone, and so it doesn't have any sustainable life. It's not like a traditional gas well. So that's also something that must be considered. Also, they're taking valuable water, especially in the West, in Oklahoma, in Wyoming, in Colorado, and other places where they're already grossly deficient in water supplies for agriculture, industry, and populations. They're pulling on those water resources, and it's causing enormous conflict. We'll get into that a little later. Let's go over now and say hello to Dr. Nate Higgins. Nice to have you with us.
Hi, Gary.
What is the relationship, or the equation as it is, between peak fossil fuels, current rates of supply and demand, and our financial environment? And during the recent recession, prices collapsed to $35 a barrel, which Kurt was mentioning how where it was and where it is now, and then rose again to where it has been hovering a little over $100 a barrel. And how does the financial sector destabilize the entire pricing of energy? And also speak on the energy supply and demand relationship that has brought the U.S. and the developed world to the precipice of decline. And when we speak of peak oil and other peak fuels, how much does this contribute to the decline of the social system and even federal governments of the country?
What was the middle thing? No, I'm kidding. I'll try and address that. You know, we go through the daily motions in our economies, in our society, on some flawed assumptions that have kind of worked for a very long time, but we take for granted without understanding the real drivers. And one of those assumptions is that money is what has value, when in reality it's energy and natural resources, but particularly energy, that are the real natural worth and wealth in our economies. Every single transaction in GDP in our society requires energy as a precursor. And energy, the price of energy, even at $100 a barrel, what it provides to us is orders of magnitude more work than that $100. Yet we treat it, that $100 at the store, the same as a pack of books or some dog food or a new pillow. Anything worth $100 is worth $100. The reality is that one barrel of oil has 5.7 million British thermal units of potential energy. You translate that into work, it's 1,700 kilowatt hours of work. For you and I digging ditches or shoveling snow, in my case, or hauling boxes or doing manual labor, we can do about 6/10 of 1 kilowatt hour per day of work. If you extrapolate that out to 270 workable days per year, one barrel of oil substitutes around 11 years of human labor. At the average American salary of $45,000 a year, $100 barrel of oil subsidizes or displaces $500,000 of human salary. Of course, in the global average would be much less than that because we're a very rich country. But that's basically the story of industrialization, is we have replaced human labor by vast amounts of incredibly cheap fossil labor at a very energy inefficient way. For example, we drive a car, and the average car, after stopping and being in traffic and all that, gets you around 30 miles per hour versus walking at 3 miles per hour. So we're able to go 10 times faster. But in order to get to that point, we had to use 100 times more energy in the building of the car, in the building of the roads, in the infrastructure, and depending on the boundaries, much more than that. So what happens is energy is so pervasive in our economies that when the prices go up, it causes everything to get more expensive. Remember, this cheap energy, this incredibly cheap energy, which basically on all human intents and purposes is indistinguishable from magic, is provided some combination of more people, higher standards of living, higher wages, higher profits, lower price stuff. And as energy extraction, forget about how much we're paying at the pump. The important thing to look at is how much the energy companies are having to pay to extract this primary energy from the earth. As extraction costs increase, and oil extraction costs have increased 17% a year since 2002. So basically, it used to be $8 a barrel of oil, and now is, you know, close to 80 or 90 to get a barrel out of the ground. As that trend continues to be more and more expensive, the good stuff is gone, there's plenty of the other stuff left, but it costs more, that whole series of benefits to our economies unwinds. And how the financial part fits in is, you know, our economies are on life support right now. At the top, we're doing fine. But, you know, there's a large number of people. I think like 30% of American families have no savings. 40-some percent have enough in savings to cover 3 months of expenses. And something like half of U.S. retirees have less than $25,000 total. So what's happening is we keep borrowing from different areas in order to keep this economic business as usual afloat, and money cannot create energy, but money can extract energy faster. So with quantitative easing and all these artificially low interest rates, too big to fail guarantees, and the central bank largesse is all keeping the liquidity in the energy and financial markets there so that demand stays up, but it's really not sustainable what's going on.
I'd like to explore two separate areas that I believe are essential for our understanding our resources. 10 years ago, we did a series of programs over 1 week talking about peak water. And at that time, we were told that we didn't have a problem with peak water, that 1% of the world's water was clean and healthy, drinkable, and as long as we used it properly, everything would be fine. I remember at the time suggesting to this person that you haven't taken into account what could happen if our temperatures begin to rise. This is before global warming became a hot issue, and just before, about a year before, Al Gore and his movie started to make this an issue. Well, today, as we speak, we now have one half of America in severe drought. We have seven states that are simply not going to be able to be sustainable in the future. No matter what happens now, it's too late. And some of these are major states, including California, Arizona, Nevada, Colorado, Kansas, Wyoming, and Georgia, for example, and much of Florida. And yet, the average person is unaware of this. The value of the property is bubbled in all in many areas based upon the quality of life and the temperature. You want nice weather, you go to Florida, you go to Southern California. But people are not saying, beyond the taxes or no taxes, homesteading or none, does everything exist there for me to be able to have a sustainable life? And the answer is, in many cases, no. So we have peak water. We're beyond that. And now no one would have guessed, if you had this conversation about, hey, we're going to have to take 2 million acres out of California agriculture. We're going to have to turn off the water that had been historically provided for the last 58 years to these communities. Nobody would have believed that, but that's happened in the last 10 days. And it's only going to get worse because the Sierra Nevada range, 400-mile range, doesn't have any snow. And this is when it should be packed with snow, at least 6 feet. So now let's take a look at what it means when we look at oil. Because we've been led to believe that we have abundant oil, and we just have to get to it. So we're doing, as you mentioned, we've picked the low-hanging fruit. Now you're looking at very risky oil, including in the Arctic. When they go up to the Arctic, that's a very shallow seabed, in many places 500 feet. They're also not counting on the release of methane gas. They're not counting upon what happens if there's freak weather and it freezes and breaks these derricks where you could not possibly then go in there and fix it. Talk, if you would, please, about our lack as a society of wanting to be honest about the problems we face. Because if we did, there would be economic and political consequences. If the governor of California had to be honest at this moment, which he's not, he's half honest, he would have to say, you should be looking for other places to live, A, because you're on an earthquake fault down the whole California coast, B, because you're in a permanent drought and hence fire cannot is everywhere, and we cannot guarantee that your house wouldn't burn down if you're in wooded areas or even in some suburban areas. And we're running out of water. We just do not have enough water. Yes, there is some water, but there's not enough water for everyone's needs. So we're going to have to make sacrifices. The market would just plummet. The value of real estate would crash. The taxes, homeowners' taxes, would crash. The amount of deficit would be run. The consequences to being honest at this point about anything in our society is substantial. Take us through this concept as you've seen it, as you know it, about what we're really faced with.
Well, you bring up several interesting questions. Let me first talk about water. In the long, long run, I would argue that water is more important than oil or natural gas, obviously. But I would also argue that peak water, as you described it, is really highly correlated with the peak of affordable, cheap energy, because the same amount of water exists that always has. It's just not in the right locations, or it's dirtier and not potable. And if we had a 1 cent a kilowatt hour energy source, we could desalinate and move water where it needed to be. So the water shortages you speak of are really energy shortages. To your other point, elected officials right now are simply unable to tell the truth, even if they know the truth, for some of the reasons you said. First of all, it immediately causes them to be unelectable. Secondly, and more importantly, perhaps, is they lose status. So you can tell the truth to yourself, maybe, to small groups of people, yes, to a large audience of 50 or 80 people, you can tell a lot of the truth. But when you start talking about thousands or tens of thousands or millions of constituents, you're limited to what is socially acceptable. And right now, the environmental cues that we're looking at, the S&P has been trading down the last couple of weeks, but basically is at all-time highs. The economy, as far as nominal GDP growth, is still growing. So these sort of danger signs that we're talking about are not being repeated in the areas that people trust, you know, CNN and Fox News and the newspapers. So it all kind of sounds like fringe. And I would argue that the system isn't broken. It's working perfectly for how a biological organism and species found this cache of energy, and we're kind of burning through it. And I think we need to be educated on both the supply and the demand drivers of what we face, because once something wicked this way comes, the more people that really understand that it's energy is what we have to spend, money's just who controls the energy, the economy is part of the environment, not vice versa, biology determines what we need, culture determines what we have and how we get it, etc. Once people understand those maxims, we're going to make better decisions. But finally, on the, you know, politicians talking about our problems subject, there's a lot of cognitive biases at work, cognitive dissonance, denial, self-deception, because it's not as if we could just kind of change our ways 10% or 15% and everything would be fine. We're talking about some pretty large paradigm shifts to make the trajectories a little bit more benign. And all of what we're talking about, of course, revolves around less consumption. And telling people to either defer consumption or reduce immediate consumption is not and has never been a popular thing, even though most of us could probably drop our consumption in half and it would be healthier for our bodies and for our lifestyles. And finally, one thing I'll add that your articulate first guest didn't mention is in the viewpoint of our species finding this fossil magic a couple hundred years ago, you know, what happens in the Bakken Shale and this hydrofracked gas and oil is kind of irrelevant. Even if the people that are optimistic about how much we have left and we've got plenty for the American future, well, for what, 20, 30, 40 years, then what? So I think we need like a 100-year plan or a 500-year plan that looks at all these environmental economic consequences and how are we going to navigate through that? What sort of things should we aspire to? What kind of infrastructure and ethics and species do we want to get through that bottleneck? I think those questions are not remotely being addressed.
I would agree. I do have one short follow-up question for you on what you just said, and that is our current pace of transitioning from fossil fuels to renewable energy sources. And given that sources, as you suggest, are dwindling, the cost for extracting fossil fuels is increasing dramatically, such as deep ocean drilling, and the quality of the resources, such as tar sand oil, is much dirtier and more expensive to refine. And we put all these together, what socioeconomic impact will this have on the energy needs of the country, for example, agriculture, which requires tremendous amounts of energy, and the lives of the average citizen? And there are financial and agricultural and transportation and industry implications and much more. In other words, what will a peak fossil fuel world look like?
Well, I'll take my stab at that, and then maybe Kurt wants to add something. I think this is all going to manifest in limits to growth. There are physical limits to growth, like we don't have the resources to grow anymore. There are environmental limits to growth, biodiversity, ocean acidification, climate change, et cetera. But there are also social limits to growth. And when you hollow out the middle class and cause that to be a very small portion of society, you've already hit social limits to growth. And I expect that could be the first signal of peak fossil fuels. If you hear me hesitating, I have a very affectionate coonhound on my lap that's trying to get something. So I think the end of growth is what the first wave of this is going to look like, is economies are going to stop growing. And once that happens, we cross an inflection point, and all the rules that we had before start to change. I would argue that for a while, Gary, we will have cheap fossil fuels after that point. If the economy demand goes down faster than the decline rates of oil and gas, for a little while there, 5 or 10 years or whatever, we're going to have plenty of fossil fuels at prices that people can afford because the economy will have crashed. And then that'll, of course, send another short-term signal that energy is really not the reason that we got to this point. It's something else. It's the Republicans or the Chinese or the environmentalists or something like that. When in truth, it is a higher extraction cost for a finite material that is central to our economies was the main driver. So the short answer to your question is I expect very soon the United States economy and soon after that the world economy will peak in its amount of global annual output and never again reach that level.
Nice insights there. Please stay with us. You're listening to Dr. Nate Higgins from Wisconsin and also from Oregon, Kurt Cobb. And Kurt, to you on this, very few people pay attention to the consequences of global warming. Those of us in the field who are environmentalists, we do. But the average person doesn't. Even today, I was discussing the fact that China has now officially recognized that it's lost 26,000 rivers. And it also recognized that 2.5 billion years of life have been lost based upon giving free coal to 500 million people in the north part of China to heat their homes, and that causes 5.5 years of life to be lost because of the pollution and congestion diseases that coal production in a home causes. Its air is one of the most polluted in the world, and in fact, 12 of the most polluted cities in the world are in China, but also you have Mexico City. You have some terrible pollution problems due to coal. And yet, you do not hear the commentaries on television or on radio, for that matter, talking about what will it mean for the average person if we don't change the way that we're producing energy? Why can't we look at geothermal or solar or wave power, which is endless, that we could pull out of rivers, and they're currently doing that in the Hudson River, I've seen it, as well as in the ocean, and they're not. They're not having this discussion. So take us on that journey of what we're not paying attention to, pollution, its consequences to human health and to the environment and to river and to drinkable water. Someday we will have to pay a price for.
Well, I actually think we're already paying the price for it. But let me start with climate change, because I did sort of allude to that in my original remarks that, you know, I'm talking about supply of fossil fuels and how much we have, and all without regard to climate change, because that seems to be missing in our discussion, and it's the intention of the fossil fuel industry that it be missing in our discussion and that we just talk about supply. And that's nonsense, of course, because we're already seeing these predicted effects of climate change, terrible, intense storms, floods, droughts. It's not something, climate change is not something that's going to happen in the future. Climate change is happening. Now, as a friend of mine said to me when we were discussing peak oil, she said, human society can survive peak oil. You know, there will be consequences, but we may not be able to survive climate change. The species may be threatened to extinction by climate change. And I think that's, you know, climate change is a problem that in some ways is an order of magnitude more important and more devastating than peak resources. And I think you also talk about pollution and the consequences of all these toxins in our environment, in our water, in our food, in our air, and what it's doing to human health. Well, so much of that is driven by the cheap, what was previously the cheap availability of fossil fuels. We were able to do so many things. We were able to perform so many industrial miracles, to have so many factories, because we had cheap fossil fuels to run them. And, of course, those factories created chemicals and spewed them into the air and into the water, created chemicals for agriculture to kill the pests and to kill the weeds that we don't want in farm fields. And so in some ways, the fossil fuel revolution from that began 200 years ago is really the major cause of the of all the other pollutants that we have today, because we've been able to either invent chemicals or liberate things like arsenic and uranium from the ground, and it gets spread all over the place. So in some ways, our cheap energy is killing us. We think of cheap energy as being a boon to the human race, but in fact, in many ways, it's destroying our health, and it is poisoning our food, and it is changing our climate. So I would say, rather than argue that we don't have enough energy, what I would say is we are suffering now from the consequences of having too much energy. And another way to think about this is we're paying the entropy bill for all that energy that we expended in the form of the dispersion of poisons and pollution and in climate change. So that's a very short way of talking about that whole set of problems related to energy use.
I'd like for you to, Kurt, to continue for another moment here on the XL Keystone pipeline from the Alberta tar sand fields to the refineries on the Texas coast being treated as such a high priority in Washington. And in my opinion, it's a foregone conclusion that Obama, through John Kerry and the State Department, will pass this, because virtually every position in this administration of this president is filled with a major corporate entity, a supporter of the corporatization and neoliberal policies. So if we are supposed to be moving towards greater energy independence, and much of this is based upon our fossil fuel resources, then why is this push to open up the XL Keystone pipeline so essential at this moment? What is the rush on this?
Well, the rush is for profits, of course, because large international oil companies, which control most of the development of the tar sands, want to use an existing network of pipelines. Because you've got to understand, and this is the bizarre thing about what's going on in the case of the Keystone XL pipeline, is that Canada imports 40% of its oil. And that's because of this curious phenomenon of most of the pipelines running north-south, most of the crude that is exported from Canada comes south to our refineries. So in the end, it's the cheapest thing to do, is to build an extension of an existing pipeline system and bring more of it down to the Gulf Coast, where, frankly, our refineries have extra capacity because Americans are driving less and using less gasoline. So the refineries, the owners of the refineries, the international oil companies, would love to have extra cheap crude come down to them in the Gulf so they can fill up their refineries and make more product, not for the American public, but for export. That's what's going to happen. Now, the Canadians have a fallback plan. They're trying to push a possible pipeline through British Columbia to sell some of that tar sands oil to Asia. But there's also another plan to move, to change a natural gas pipeline and have it run oil from west to east in Canada, and then make Canada essentially energy independent, because they would be able to do that. But for some reason, and this is puzzling to me, the Canadians seem to be completely unconcerned about their own energy independence. They seem to be focused on this Keystone XL extension that is really just a profit-making machine for the international oil companies. And that may be the reason that they're focused on it, is that both administrations have bowed to the oil interests and what they want. So I think that's the dynamic. Now, the sad thing is I know that a lot of climate activists have been focusing on the Keystone Pipeline as a symbol of our ongoing climate disaster, and they would like to prevent it. The trouble is, even if we do prevent it, I'm positive that the Canadians are going to move that oil from Western Canada to Eastern Canada through a pipeline that they are already to re-outfit, or they're going to move it west to the Asian. So I think that no matter what we do at this point, unless we decide we're going to use less oil overall worldwide, that oil is going to get out to some market.
Of course, when you look at the environmental destruction around those pits, it's just horrific. You can actually see this from satellites in space, it's so large and so devastating. Then again, in the state of Montana and Wyoming, at nighttime, satellites pick up what look like little cities. Those are actually from the gas pipes, the fracking that's going on there. Nate, over to you. Since the U.S. is still very addicted to coal, and we do not seem to be moving quickly enough to replace it with non-fossil fuel sources, what impact will the scenario that Kurt provides have on energy supplies and cost when it comes to coal? And also when we look at countries like China that are heavily dependent upon coal for its electricity and the filthy processes necessary to convert coal to electricity, and then when we look at the consequences in that country, air pollution off the charts, the majority of its rivers and lakes are dead, the fish can't live, and the horrendous rate of illnesses and cancers I mentioned earlier on the program, all associated with over-coal production, what has been the cost to this nation in relying so heavily upon the private coal industry?
Well, I don't think all of their lakes and rivers are dead, but they certainly, you know, I've lived in China before, and there's a whole lot of people there, and when there's a lot of people and they're moving up the consumption ladder, there's going to be large environmental costs, and I don't know the answer other than they cannot and the world cannot continue on the trajectory that they're on. And keep in mind that we like to pride ourselves on becoming more energy efficient, and the energy intensity of our GDP is declined. In other words, we're producing more GDP with less energy, and our CO2 emissions have gone down. But a lot of that is kind of smoke and mirrors, because we've outsourced the heavy lifting to China, and China is making all these wind turbines and solar panels and machinery using heavy coal-intensive industry. So since the economy is incredibly global, you have to look at the global CO2 emissions and the global environmental impact, because we're just kind of outsourcing it and living high off the hog while keeping our nature relatively pristine here. All of this gets to the unspoken question of how do we transition to a lower consumption society? And I don't think democracy nor capitalism can handle such a transition. And I don't think the transition is going to come because of facts and people like Kurt and I, you know, shouting that this is not going to work. It's going to come of its own accord sooner or later, and we're going to have to respond. And I think people can do things to better prepare themselves, and communities and states and countries can do things as well. But I don't see a whole lot of it. It's hard to scale back the use of a lot of this fun and comfortable and novel and exciting stuff that we have on our daily smorgasbord.
How much of our problems with these fuels, coal and oil and gas, are also in the control of those commodity traders who are now known to manipulate the price? We've seen, for example, in the last 12 months, we have seen people caught on Wall Street manipulating the LIBOR and manipulating the price of gold and silver, manipulating the price of currencies and commodities. And these are very, very powerful commodities. And at one time, in about 2007 and 8, the price of oil went skyrocketed, and we later found out that was no small part because of at least two individuals, groups, one at Citibank, for example, and one at Bank of America, that were trading back and forth. Neither was ever going to take a barrel of oil, but they manipulated the price up so they could make huge profits. And based upon how many gallons of barrels of oil a day were sold, at the increased profits, they made hundreds of millions of dollars. And yet that was completely legal, but extremely immoral in that nothing was done to prevent that in the future. Your thoughts on that part of the scenario?
Well, what you're really talking about is that we have come to worship money as the goal of our lives and not some sort of real economic goods and industry. And, you know, I used to work on Wall Street, and I had clients that were billionaires, and all they wanted to do was catch up to their other billionaire friends who were richer than them. And I don't think that we can blame the rich for these problems. It's society created these rules, and the rich are just executing and following them. We need to change the rules. I think you're right that if there were more regulations on futures trading and foreign exchange trading, where if you trade an oil future, you have to take delivery, meaning you need it for your business or something like that, or you're a producer and you sell it, and a large percentage of the buyers and sellers of those items never even care about seeing the eventual product. But if we remove all of those people, that will change the price, but not that much, because ultimately it gets back to the extraction costs. But what will happen is those people will be better allocated in a society doing something more productive rather than just spinning around speculation and over-concentrating wealth, which in itself is probably not healthy, but when you do it in the hundreds of millions or billions or tens or hundreds of billions scale, it destabilizes the system, which is what you saw with Lehman Brothers and a couple times in Europe. So the question is, I agree with you, we need to regulate that better, but how to do that without tipping the apple cart?
I'd like to conclude today with each of you addressing this issue, and Nate will continue with you. You'll be first. My concern is that we are still predicating our entire economic model of casino capitalism upon growth. And that's what's caused a lot of the problems in China, in India, and in Brazil. And yet, many of us believe that we should be looking at a new way of dealing with the future where it's not growth but sustainability. And there are millions of people who are now trying to become more conscious and more stable. But you start talking with the average American that they should be cutting back on different usages that they cannot afford in the future, and they won't like that. And you talk with any of the major corporations, including many of the ones that used to work for on Wall Street, their whole survival is based upon creating the idea that we have to continue growing. If we stop growing, then we die. How do we reconcile what we need? We would have to have 3.5 planets to continue right now with the needs of the growing markets, the emerging markets, and our own market. Your thoughts on this, please.
Well, if you consider the media and television and movies and advertising, to tell people or to teach them to be more sustainable is like telling a teenage girl to dress uglier. It's just not going to work. It goes against the biological drives of what they're trying to compete for and measure up against their peers. So only when the media and the Madison Avenue and the marketing and the whole cultural metric shifts away from growth will people be able to say, look at how little I lived on last year. I'm a minimalist. I'm cool. And right now, yes, there are a lot of people thinking about sustainability, like yourself, talking about it, but we're not in power. The people in power work for institutions that are designed on growth. And in fact, if there is truly an end of growth, those institutions' functionality ceases to exist, so they're at threat. Eventually, we're going to need institutions that and governments that look at this from an ecological perspective. I think one of the great battles of the 21st century isn't going to be between China and the U.S. or something like that. It's going to be between businessmen and ecologists, people that make decisions based on dollars and people that make decisions based on ecological principles, natural resources, energy, environmental limits. And, you know, we have to have an educated citizenry that understands those things in order to have a democracy that votes into people, into power that talk about these things. Because otherwise, it's just we're going to go off a cliff that way.
Very much appreciate those inputs, Dr. Nate Higgins. And final short comment from you, Kurt Cobb, on the same issue, please.
Well, I think that Nate said we're going to need a different kind of government. And right now we have, and a different kind of politics, we have a politics in which we don't want politics. We say, well, if we just grow, then we don't have to deal with the issue of redistribution. And that is, I think, the singular biggest sort of stumbling block to a new politics is that we haven't had to talk as much about redistribution in a growing economy as we would if growth stopped. And so it's hard for us to conceive of especially in this country, of a politics where we really got to talk about redistribution because that's the only thing that's left to talk about. But let me, if we have a little more time, do we?
We just have one more minute.
Okay. There is another phenomenon, and that is we have a simplicity movement worldwide, and we also have a long tradition of asceticism in usually religious but sometimes secular movements. So there is a part of the human experience that understands that increasing our consumption, increasing our appetites, is not always a way to happiness. And what I'm hoping is that that part of us can get actuated, and it would be consistent with a more sustainable society.
Makes a lot of sense. Thank you, Kurt Cobb, for being with us, and Dr. Nate Hagans. I'm Gary Nall. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Thank you all very much for listening.